Hello. It may seem improbable that someone like me, Alexander Stevenson, who has committed himself to producing a 96-episode monstrosity of a podcast about the Napoleonic period, hasn't seen Sir Ridley Scott's epic, spectacle-filled action movie blockbuster sort of hit, Napoleon, brackets 2023, close brackets. But due to complex and tedious health issues, the fact of the matter is that, yeah, I haven't seen this film. Or I haven't until now, because with the aid of expensive movie buying purchases, I am slowly working my way through it 5 minutes a day and turning those watching experiences into this podcast in gold with assistance from my screenwriting friend, James Topham. Hello, James.
Hello, Alex. Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Here we are once again. And so now, having watched the first 45 minutes, it's been time for us to consider minutes 45 to 60. Boy, oh boy, what minutes they are. James, I, for one, am controversially, well, I'm certainly very much looking forward to talking to you about this, but I've got to say, I really, really enjoyed this 15 minutes.
Did you, Alex? Well, that does not surprise me one bit. Possibly the worst 15 minutes that we've had thus far, but that's only in screenwriting terms. I'm sure you're bringing lots of different points of view to it.
Well, that's why we're bringing our own perspectives, aren't we, here? And I think for listeners to the Napoleonic Quarterly, there'll be a lot of benefit from hearing your screenwriting words of wisdom. Anyway, let's get cracking, James. Over to you.
Yeah, okay. Let's dive in. So, 45 minutes. Thankfully, I'd imagine for your listeners, we are back onto the politics after, I don't know, 10 minutes of Josephine-based lovers quibbling. Napoleon leaves the welcome bosom of Josephine and is at some kind of council, perhaps a meeting of some kind of political soiree.
He's been called back to be accountable for his actions in abandoning the army of Egypt.
By the Directory, I believe.
Yeah, the Directory, the five-man governing Directory of France.
Weren't you, Alex, the head of something called the Directory when you were at school?
James, I thought you would bring this up. And it's true that I did consider it appropriate to establish a directory briefly when I was about 14 or 15. It was a very successful operation, which at its peak saw me being escorted between lessons by directory bodyguards, and I literally had bag carriers for me carrying my bags around. But then I got a flu or a cold or something and had to take a few days off, and I left the whole operation in charge of my second in command, who just didn't have the natural charisma that I had at that age, and the whole thing fell apart.
Well, interestingly, how fragile these directories can be, as we may find in the next few minutes. It seems a bit like you going off on your cold. The directory has been running France quite poorly, certainly in Napoleon's opinion. He's laying it down to them. Who is going to look after France when Napoleon is out of the country on his foreign adventures?
Well, there was one line that puzzled me. I mean, the specific line he used was, who should be responsible for her, France's governance, while I'm away? And I wanted to ask you about that, James. It could be brilliant characterization because he was quite important at the time. But at the same time, was that overwriting in the sense that he was a bit too big for his boots there, really, to be saying, well, I'm away?
Well, it's a power play as well, isn't it? He's been dragged in front of these people for desertion, basically, from his post in Egypt. But he's turning the tables on them. He's kind of taking the more powerful role in the conversation. So I think you're right. I think you're right, Alex.
But then why does he say, at the end of that scene, and at the end of his big, you know, list of people who shouldn't be responsible for France, he says, added to that, the discovery that my wife is a slut. What's going on there?
So So some things, Alex, can't be explained by screenwriting theory. They can only, you know, the magic just happens on the page, and I think that's one of them. I think entirely inexplicable as a line.
Maybe it's a deliberate strategy that, in fact, we have seen this, that there are odd, weird things that he says that baffle and confuse, because he's just a crazy guy who says strange things.
Yes, yeah, that's one interpretation. No, I think that's right. I think he's, you know, it goes back to his Corsican roots and this roughness. You know, he's the kind of man who would say, "My wife's a slut."
He's gauche.
He's gauche, Alex. I could not agree more. Could not agree more. But he's a gauche man on the up, as it were, because in the next scene is speaking with a young, ambitious buck who thinks that with Napoleon by his side, he can run France. And the idea that he's proposing is this rule by three consuls. And, you know, for a man planning on staging a coup, he's using very straightforward language, I would say. He's being very direct, mainly, I assume, so that he can deliver what is quite inexplicable exposition to any audience member who doesn't know the intricacies of how France was ruled at the time.
I don't think this is the worst example of bad exposition in this 15 minutes. I think that in this case, it's mitigated to a very large effect by the really excellent development of Julian Rind Tutt's wrinkles emanating out from his eyes, which look really good.
Yep. Max from Green Wing, 20 years on, he looks incredible.
Agreed.
So, as is often the case in this film, there's no time for Napoleon to consider this offer or prevaricate, because as is the case in this screenplay, as we've seen many times before, the structural rule of the story is that if something is proposed in one scene, it immediately has to happen in the next.
And that's normal for all screenplays, isn't it?
Well, I suppose ones that are trying to fit the entire Napoleonic War into three and a half hours, yeah. So the next sequence is what we call in the screenwriting biz a montage. It comes from the French word for montage. With various members of the directory being interrupted mid-breakfast and being forced to resign by soldiers, including one, Citizen Moulin, who is most perturbed and refuses to be disturbed while he is eating his succulent breakfast.
Yeah, I've noted that line. I am enjoying a succulent breakfast. We're trying to grow succulents at the moment as we try and get into houseplants and that sort of thing.
That is a very relevant point you make there. Alex, are you aware of the internet meme of Democracy Manifest?
No.
So it features an Australian man who has been arrested for dining and dashing at an Australian Chinese restaurant, and it involves some TV footage of him shouting to a crowd of local TV reporters, including the line, "What's the crime to eat a succulent Chinese meal?"
Well, that's relevant. That is definitely relevant here. Okay.
So there's a big question, Alex, whether Citizen Moulin's arrest is an allusion to this 1990s internet meme Democracy Manifest. And I must say that the actor who plays Moulin has been made up to have more than a passing resemblance to the man at the centre of that meme.
What is going on? That's mad. Surely it's more likely that the screenwriter would have just watched the meme as they were struggling for something to put into this montage, which is French for montage.
You think it could be a subconscious borrowing?
Well, I suppose as is a bit of a theme emerging, isn't it, in our this little sub-series that, you know, how charitable are we inclined to be?
Well, look, I think your listeners will have to be the ultimate decision maker there, but I point them in the direction of that meme. Anyway, the directory's out of the way and we move on to the coup. And how, Alex, from a screenwriting perspective, do we know that a coup is about to happen?
James, I think this is signalled to the viewer through the block capitals that appears on the screens with the two words, the coup.
Correct, correct. Classic screenwriting technique. Just tell people what's going to happen on screen. I guess maybe we're in Versailles?
I mean, sorry, James, it's called screenwriting for a reason, isn't it? Do you write things on the screen?
It's not called screen listening, Alex. So I guess maybe we're in Versailles. Question mark?
No, it's not Versailles. They very deliberately hustled them out to a place called Malmaison, basically out of Paris, so away from the revolutionary mob, away from the crowds, so they wouldn't be able to have any hand in it.
Ah, no, you're right. They do say we are not in Paris anymore. You're quite right. Napoleon and his fellow conspirators are, slightly awkwardly, I would say, waiting in the wings as these assembly of members refuse to allow Napoleon to take up his leadership position. And unable to bear this criticism, Napoleon runs out in a foolhardy manner into the clutches of the assembly. And I would say this is possibly the first real moment of jeopardy for Napoleon.
It certainly is. But James, I'm very interested to know what you think of this as a portrayal of this interesting chapter in this story, because it goes badly wrong for Napoleon very quickly.
Yes, he's not given any dignity at all. He's breathing hard. He's shouting at a crowd who aren't listening to him. He's attacked by assembly members and only manages to escape by falling rather unceremoniously down some steps.
In his defence, he doesn't shout about succulent breakfasts at all.
No. I think he says something along the lines of you're going against the Constitution, or words to that effect.
James, the truth is, this is, I think, very accurate to what actually happened. I think this is a fantastic portrayal of the crisis of Brumaire, these moments. I think I absolutely love this.
Yep, it's painting Napoleon in an undignified light. You know, it makes him look a little bit foolish, I think.
Listen,
but I think that really gets us into the middle of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Listen to the episode when we talk through this in the Napoleonic Quarterly, episode, 32 maybe? The Outlaw's Coup. It's a great episode. And the actual real version of this, it seems pretty close. The only thing that they missed out is that Napoleon was supposed to have sustained a small cut on his cheek as a result of the scuffles, which was the result, so they claim, to the soldiers outside, of an assassination attempt, which was obviously absurd. But nevertheless, he shouts, "They're trying to kill me!"
He does. Now, what I think is a really interesting moment is what happens when, and I assume it's a historical moment, might be worth a history check with you, Alex, but his brother draws his sword on Napoleon and threatens to run him through if Napoleon was ever to betray France, in order to, I guess, to convince the soldiers outside to come to their side.
Please email me at, it's napoleonicquarterly@gmail.com if I'm wrong, but I think what was said in episode 32 is that it was something along those lines exactly, yeah. And whilst we don't know that Lucien Bonaparte gave Napoleon that little, "Come on, they're all watching us," little side look, that was good acting. I think most of it, I think it works. I think it's true to what happened.
Ah.
Yeah,
it's great. It's played for laughs, but I think it's pretty successful. And of course, the soldiers rush in and, immediately subdue these troublesome deputies, holding them at gunpoint. And then Napoleon returns slightly less flustered than he previously was, with what's, I think, quite a nice line.
It's a great line. I love that line, which is, "Shall we vote?" But he's kind of breathless. "Shall we vote?"
That's very good. Your Joaquin Phoenix goes from strength to strength, Alex.
Yeah, I need to try and make it a bit more kind of...
Yeah.
I'm kind of looking down my next jawline sags down to my chest to try to get that drawl. Shall we vote? I'll work on it.
You can keep working on it. So, a big moment for Napoleon. He and Josephine pass out of the doors of the house to awaiting jubilant crowns.
Sorry, I really have interrupted then.
Well, we're teetering on a threshold here, Alex, but go on, please.
It's a threshold, which got me thinking of what you said in the last episode about the end of the first act. That's when a character has to cross the threshold. And you were saying that the end of the first act of this film was clearly Napoleon Bonaparte making that decision to abandon the French troops in Egypt and get back to his unfaithful wife, Josephine, back in France, that was the threshold that he crossed. And OK, that makes sense. But could it be the case that there is an alternative threshold, a literal threshold here, the threshold of this door beyond which lies government?
I think you might be right. I think, Alex, that we may be here on the cusp of the end of Act One. And the reason why, from a screenwriting perspective, I think that may be the case is because often at the end of an act, what you will see is a character achieving what they want.
Ah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about wants and needs.
Yes, yes. And what he wants is power and the opportunity for destiny. And what he needs is not so clear, but maybe he needs Josephine.
Well, I think often what we don't know, he won't know what he needs until he encounters it in the second act, because what he'll be thrust into in the second act is a realization that what he wanted isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. Great. Okay, you're making the experience of watching this film all the better. And I just think if all of the many disappointed Napoleonic Quarterly listeners had you sat next to them in the cinema, and maybe the film was paused every 15 minutes or even every 1 minute, then they might have enjoyed it more.
So, what better way to celebrate becoming first consul than Napoleon to have a party? And here, possibly in the first scene of Act Two, Alex, something of remarkable magnitude happens, something that arguably we've been waiting for the entire film to this point. It's the introduction of Napoleon's mother.
I was so excited when I saw her name appear on the subtitles, which is, of course, how you find out these things out. It's a big moment. We've been building up to it a lot. We've had the mummy issues in Egypt. We've had the horse bullet and Napoleon Bonaparte saying to Lucien, "Take this to my mother," and then. And then we had the Josephine line, which unnecessarily included his mother in their marriage.
Yes, yes. All setting up this moment. And it's quite a short scene, Alex, but I think we're starting to see the beginning of a character dynamic as well. What do you think about Napoleon's mother and her treatment of Josephine in that scene?
It's very Downton Abbey.
Very Downton Abbey, Alex. Very Downton Abbey.
or a P.G. Woodhouse, a Blanding's aunt, perhaps, who's disapproving. There's a lot of disapproval. Of course, everyone knows about Josephine's bad behaviour, so maybe that's a part of it. Josephine is strangely absent in these 15 minutes, not on screen, but in terms of the words she says. I think her only line is, "What are we doing?" or something like that before the great threshold is crossed. You can see her speaking in sort of socialite mode. Well, she's more than a socialite. She's the first lady of France, sort of. But no on-screen lines. She doesn't. I'm not sure that the acting that she displays much disappointment in response to Napoleon's mother's snub, which is to instantly catch the eye of somebody else who we're going to talk about a lot, I suspect. But put that to one side. But that's how it goes, isn't it? She says, "Oh, Josephine, oh, look, there's Charles/Ben Miles.
Yep, Ben Miles is going to be a big, because, and what Ben Miles represents for me, Alex, in this, with this introduction into the film is the oncoming of tremendous boring. Because Ben Miles represents a turn to the complexities of foreign policy in Napoleon's rule. Complexities that I have neither interest in nor desire to follow, but we'll do our best. So
that's a real shame, James, I've got to say. There's so much of interest in Napoleon's foreign policy, and I would just encourage you to give it a try. How about listen to the next 60 episodes of the Napoleonic Quarterly and just see if you like it or not, and then after that, make a decision as to whether or not you're interested.
Look, I don't think I'll be doing that, Alex. So Napoleon finds himself thrown into foreign policy issues. Firstly, he's writing a letter to the English offering his hand of friendship. He's doing it a bit cack-handedly. His secretary has to correct him in his use of an honorific.
And I was very interested in this. I quite like the writing there. Why would you show this slightly awkward correction there? Is it to show Napoleon Bonaparte as being somebody who's not very au fait with a French word, which here means familiar, with the niceties of diplomatic conventions? Or is it some other character thing? What would you say, James?
No, I think that's right. I think, look, it's this man who you've described as being gauche only a few moments earlier, arriving on the scene and not understanding the complexities of what's going to happen. And again, it goes back to what we talked about when he crossed the threshold, right? He gets what he wants. He gets power. He has control. But very quickly, he starts to realise, well, is this all it's cracked up to be? Am I the man destined to be able to perform this role?
And hence the frustration that we know is coming, although we're not allowed to talk about it because it's in the next 15 minutes.
Yes, but, well, precisely, and we won't talk about it. But whilst the English are a concern to him, there's only one man really on his mind, and that is the Tsar, who he's talking to Ben Miles, or Armand de Caulaincourt, as the title aptly makes us aware, is telling Napoleon about the Tsar, what his character's like, what Napoleon should do. And I think it's quite interesting that Napoleon seems to perk up his interest when Ben Miles says that the Tsar wants him to be popular.
That is the key line that I latched on. And Joaquin Phoenix says something like, he's popular, really?
Well, yeah. So look, I think your Joaquin Phoenix has gone back a little bit, but yeah, the thrust of what you're saying is right. I think what we're hearing here is Napoleon wants to be popular. He wants to be a popular ruler like the Tsar.
Yeah. Maybe this podcast isn't benefiting from my Joaquin Phoenix, but I feel like we're getting more information about Napoleon Bonaparte here than we had in the first half an hour of the film. All of a sudden, it's almost as if that first film he was totally miscast for. But maybe they should have just begun it at this stage.
I missed out on that horse cannon malarkey. It'd be a real shame. Next scene, we have a bit more politicking in what I think is a lovely lounge. It includes the butler from the recent motion picture Saltburn. And to be frank with you, I've got no idea what they're talking about. Possibly Austria's involved.
What?
There's a man with a quite ridiculous mustache.
Come on. Surely you get what's going on. It's all said so brilliantly. I love this scene so much. Okay, so Talleyrand is this was famously described as a by Napoleon Bonaparte around this time as a shit in a silk stocking. He was again being frustrated with him. He was quite a corpulent chap, but he did have that gammy leg that is portrayed. But Talleyrand is so brilliant, and he is my favourite character or individual from the Napoleonic period, because he's such a good comedy villain, and he survives all the way through, and his story is unbelievably fantastic in terms of somehow wriggling through. And so I hope we see as much of Talleyrand as possible. So I'm very, very keen on him.
And is that the butler from the recent motion picture Saltburn, or is that the ridiculous moustache man?
It's the former, yeah. It's the Saltburn butler.
Yeah, yeah.
Played by Paul Rees.
He's good. He's an excellent actor. I enjoyed his turn in the recent motion picture Saltburn.
Austria and Britain are at war with France. and Britain's paying the money, Austria's doing the fighting, essentially, at least, you know, on the continent. And so there's this spurious, well, debatable peace offering which Napoleon Bonaparte is making, having come into power, and that's what's being discussed here. And who knows?
Well, I mean, look, I think what I did take away from all this talk is that things aren't quite going Napoleon's way. He's not getting the reply from the English that he would like. And as the clock ticks over to the 60-minute mark, he does have possibly the best line in the 60 minutes to date.
You think you're so good because you have boats?
Well, that's excellent. So, firstly, a fantastic line. It might be worth doing a bit of a history check. Alex, is it the case that England did have boats at this point in history?
Yes, Britain had a large number of small craft, otherwise known as boats, but those were militarily insignificant compared to the ships of the Royal Navy.
And do you think Napoleon might be making the same mistake I did in referring to them as boats? Do you think this is another instance of Napoleon being gauche?
Well, everyone knows that Napoleon didn't have a clue about anything to do with the sea. Although that is questionable, actually, and it's not quite as... That's potentially shorthand. Again, the whole thing is debatable, really, here, because it could be that the screenwriters are deliberately putting this line in to make him look like, the word boat specifically, to make him look like he is just not very knowledgeable about all things to do with the sea, all things maritime. Or it could be that the screenwriters themselves didn't know the difference, which would obviously be unacceptable.
I can't believe that. Not when they so deftly handled the attack on the ships at Toulon with such dexterity. I can't believe that that's the case.
There they described big guns, didn't they, to distinguish them from other guns?
They did.
The ones pointing at the British ships?
The ones pointing at their own ships. Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly.
That's right. So, yeah, okay. It's problematic. I have a broader issue with the switching between the sort of periodic historical dialogue that you might get in a Jane Austen novel and the more parochial everyday things like Napoleon's mother saying "Great to see ya" or something like, you know what I mean?
yeah. Well, look, I think as a screenwriter, you've got to always be making that decision about what you make accessible to your audience. So, for example, as I was listening to all the dialogue up to the point of him saying, "You think you're so good, you have boats," I had little or no interest in what he was saying. And then as soon as he said, "You think you're so good because you have boats," I was like, yes, I understand this man. I understand what his issues are.
Well, there we go. Maybe that was brilliant screenwriting, because after all, this is aimed at people like you who, for some reason, aren't concentrating fully on the output of the Napoleonic Quarterly podcast.
Yes, for some reason.
James, we haven't covered another of my favourite lines in this episode, which was, "Come, little one, you'll get into the bed of your masters." It was...
Yeah, I think I was avoiding it purposely in case you were to do your rendition of it.
Again, it was a lot of... no dialogue from Josephine, but she was able to convey meaning through her actions.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I feel like Josephine poorly served in this 15 minutes. I think we can only hope that she's back stronger in the next 15.
So where does this leave us, James? Because I've got to say, I have really enjoyed the last 30 minutes of this film. Really enjoyed it. The first half an hour was excruciating, but maybe it's the way I'm watching it, because in the cinema, you would be so stunned and appalled by the first 30 minutes that you wouldn't have time to recover your composure. Whereas because there are days passing between me watching this and then, you know, it allows me to savour it more fully and enjoy the lines about succulent breakfasts and things. And Talleyrand, who is the best greaser ever.
Yeah, no, although I think it's gathering steam, Alex. I think whether you're in the cinema or no, this is a film that's starting to get a grip on what it wants to be.
Okay, so you mentioned a little bit about the second act. I am intrigued to know what follows. What you're saying I should look out for as I watch the next 15 minutes and thereafter is it's going to be about trying to identify how is Napoleon Bonaparte going to come up with things that make him realise that the thing that he thought he wanted is not quite all that it was cracked up to be.
I couldn't have put it better myself, Alex. A couple of other things to look out for in Act Two. Often Act Two is about the promise of the premise. The promise of the premise. So Act Two is often playing out what you've come to see the film for. So in a heist film, it's planning the heist.
In a Napoleon Bonaparte film, it's really big battles.
I suspect he's going to be doing quite a bit of Napoleon Bonaparting about the place. And the other thing to look out for in Act Two is steps forwards and setbacks. Step forwards and setbacks. Often what you'll see is this kind of like building scene on scene where you think that the protagonist is getting what they want, they're moving further towards their objective, but they'll be knocked back in the following scene and they'll have to regroup.
Okay, I can't wait. I'm properly into this now.
Well, me too, Alex. It's a joy being side by side with you on this adventure.
James, who should be responsible for the governance of this podcast while I'm away watching the next 15 minutes of this film?
Not me, Alex. Not me.